Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, 2022 has been an epic year here on the podcast, with guests ranging from individual investors to super investors. And in this, the final episode of 2022, I want to take a look at some of the best moments that happened on the show throughout the year. A bit of a highlight reel, if you will. And a big thank you to those who have consistently tuned into the podcast, either on YouTube or your chosen audio platform. Now, the best way to support the podcast is simply to keep listening and share it with a friend to help us continue growing. But if you're genuinely interested in supporting the channel, you might as well get something for yourself out of it as well. ShareSite have been a long-time partner of my main Investing with Tom YouTube channel, as well as the podcast, and you can get free access to ShareSite, which is the portfolio tracking and tax reporting tool I've been using for years at this point, down in the description below, and that link will also get you 4 months free off of an annual premium subscription to ShareSite. Now, the first highlight clip for this episode is with Guy Spier. We really started 2022 off with a bang, and Guy Spier was our very first guest on the podcast for the year. He is someone who I've followed for a very long time, is a certified super investor, and in this first clip, Guy Spier shares how he thinks about portfolio allocation and making big bets when he's picking individual stocks. I'd like to jump over to YouTube. I mentioned to you beforehand, I put up a community post on YouTube asking for some questions for this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Looks like we've got over 100 of them, so we won't get through all of them, but I'll give you a couple of the ones that I had the most thumbs up. So the first one we have is from a friend of mine, Jason, who runs a podcast and YouTube channel called After Dinner Investor. So he runs his business in the daytime and invests in the evening, hence the After Dinner Investor name. And he's asking, what's the largest position you've ever taken in one stock in terms of allocation percentage? Have you ever made a 50% bet or anything like that? Thanks.
Yeah, I have never made a 50% bet. And here's where you really have to be careful if you're kind of asking many people this question, is that you know, it's easy enough for me to open up a brokerage account, put $1,000 in it, and then put $750 into one stock and say, oh, I've had a 75% allocation. Yeah. What you really want to know is what percentage of your net worth have you put into it? And, you know, does the person have net worth in the first place? Because if you have zero net worth and you're just taking a flyer and it doesn't matter. But if you, so the first thing to say is that Aquamarine Fund is 100% or effectively. Now I've taken some money out to buy a couple of homes, but it's the vast majority of my net worth. I don't have other portfolios, positions, anything like that. So just be careful when you ask that question to people, what they're referring to. And what I would also tell you is that many people, I think, will not answer honestly, or they genuinely have not done the accounting properly in their head. So they may not be intentionally misleading you, but they just haven't thought it through. And, you know, compartmentalized financial thinking is a very, very real thing. People think in terms of, so just be really careful when you hear people say that. So having said all of that and given you as an introduction, in the one portfolio, well, I have a Charles Schwab portfolio that has a minuscule proportion of my net worth. And in that Charles Schwab portfolio, I have about 100 stocks that I buy one or two shares of in order to receive the annual reports like I just showed you. So why did this come through my door? Because I bought a couple of shares of Qualcomm and it comes through my door. Why do I tell you that? Because it's another part, just referencing back to the previous question, it's another part of that creating loops, that kind of where things come back to you so that you can reevaluate and remember. So Qualcomm, once a year, I'm going to be reminded that Qualcomm's a company that I could invest in if I wanted to. So, but coming back to the question, never invested 50%. I do believe that in Horsehead, which was a company that went bankrupt, I had 10%. And subsequent to Horsehead, I would never invest at initial cost more than 5% of my fund into a position. And I consciously know that that is going to reduce my returns. And that's just fine, because what I'm into is longevity. I'm into staying in the game and making sure I can stay in the game. And that requires me to manage my own psychology, but also to manage the psychology of my investors. And so that is a very comfortable place for me. And I would not do 10% again. And I've had a number of times now when I've invested in something that's gone down 50% and it hasn't bothered me in the slightest. And, you know, I just keep track of, I might add to it, but it is a very dangerous place when you've got made something 5, 6, 7, 10% and it's declining. And then you want to add more and suddenly you've poured half your portfolio into one stock and maybe your judgment was wrong. So, you know, keeping that kind of mental balance and finding ways to keep your mental balance. And it's kind of a visual way of thinking about it, Tom, for me, that somehow works. I don't know why, is that when the position is kind of like up to 5%, kind of a 1% position, I feel like is down below me in size. Then a 5% position is sort of coming up to my waist, so to speak. And then a 10% is above my head. You know, and I don't want positions above my head. I want them kind of down there. When I put 1 or 2% of the portfolio into Alibaba and it goes down 50%, I am just not bothered. And I know that I ought not to be bothered if I'd allocated 20% of my portfolio to it and it went down by 50%, but it would bother me. And so that's me managing my own psychology. And I think that this feeling of jumping off a cliff without really knowing where it'll end is never a good thing, I think. So, you know, you don't jump off cliffs. We carefully walk down, picking a path, finding a way to go. And if there's a, you know, I think that if somebody's saying, oh, you're a scaredy cat and you don't have big balls and you're not swinging for the fences when you ought to swing for the fences, that's kind of a voice that one should probably ignore, I think. You know, just focus on, imagine you're walking down a cliff. You don't want to jump and hope it's okay on the other side. You know, either you don't walk down the cliff, you certainly don't jump, or you wait until you find a path, and you find a path that's safe, and then you take that path. And most of the time, we're not going to find anything to do, you know? And one other thing that I would tell you, part of, again, it goes back to a previous question of yours. Why do I find it easy? I don't know if I find it easy, but why am I doing nothing? Is that I think I have a pretty good fortress, you know? A fortress that's going to carry me through whatever this time is in the markets and will get me to the other side okay. And I like my fortress and I know it well. And so kind of, I don't want to switch fortresses too often. And, you know, I like the fortresses I've got, you know, so, it would have to be really, 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 really good. And I think that I've written in the past, it's interesting. So Netflix took this huge decline and I probably haven't done enough work on it. And I know some people who, and I'm a huge fan of the CEO. But at the time that Netflix ought to have been bought 20 years ago, there was only Netflix. And now there's all these other streaming services as well. I don't know where that goes and I don't have to figure it out. So, and I'm fully invested. So not much happening.
Moving now to our second highlight clip of the year, we're going to head to Sam and Chris from the Earn More, Spend Less, and Invest the Rest YouTube channel. Now, they say that you learn far more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. And Sam and Chris actually had a fairly substantial position in their portfolio a few years back go to zero. The business went bankrupt. And that was actually a company called Horsehead Holdings, who you briefly heard Guy Spear mention in the previous highlight clip. So let's play the story of Horsehead Holdings here from Sam and Chris.
Which does lead me into, I apologize in advance, but a slightly more painful topic for you both around investing mistakes. again in our little technical issue break there, we got got talking about one of the investment mistakes that you made a few years ago in a company that probably quite a few people will be familiar with if they've followed some of the super investors that we follow, the Guy Spiers and Monish Pabrais, and also learning from, you know, someone like Phil Town. Are you happy to share that story of what happened there and maybe some learnings?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Samantha and I were invested in Horsehead. We followed a few great investors into it. We definitely were cloning them. And, you know, still we did a lot of research. We thought it was a great investment. I still look at that investment and think, well, how did that not pay off? Mm-hmm. It was, Horsehead was a zinc producer that was building this amazing zinc refining plant, I think in North Carolina. They were the low cost producer. This was going to cut their cost in half. Zinc was at a very low price. So you could make some reasonable assumptions that, you know, zinc could approach cyclical highs and that they got this plant off the ground and cut their cost basis and that this investment could 10x. And I think we also came across this at a time. It would have been only maybe that year that we had this conversation at the pool where we said, let's really work on our investing. Mm-hmm. Let's retire. Let's do some things. And we probably forgot one of our biggest rules, which was not to go all in on a single investment. Mm-hmm. And
to not get emotional because we were greedy. We were like, oh my God, if this pans out the way we think, we could be retired next year, not in 5 years, you know? Yeah. And we just let emotions take over.
Yeah. And obviously they went into Chapter 11 and shareholders
lost all of
everything.
Our money.
So, mm-hmm. it is a painful thing. Yeah. My Sirius XM, radio investment just went. So you say the wall of fame and the wall of shame, they're right next to each other.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, it was a great lesson for us to learn. There is no get rich quick scheme in investing. Mm-hmm. It's not a safe thing, you know? So it's a lot about positioning and allocation of capital and not putting all your
eggs in one basket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No matter what Warren Buffett says.
Yeah. What's the Buffett quote? It's something like, it's okay to
put all your eggs in one basket and then watch that basket.
Just watch the basket very closely. It's an interesting one because I've listened to Phil Town has a podcast episode for anyone that hasn't heard it on Horsehead, and I've listened to that a couple of times, and I try to put myself in, I guess, the shoes that you were in at the time of trying to analyze Horsehead as a potential investment, and I think I probably would have invested in it and made the same mistake, to be perfectly honest, even knowing how it panned out. I guess it's the whole idea of investing being a game of probabilities, and occasionally things come out of left field when, you know, even all the stars do seem to align. And I guess that's the reason why we, you know, have limits in terms of portfolio allocation and so on. And I believe, maybe it wasn't this company. I think it was Horsehead though, where Monish Pabrai got this call from Charlie Munger after reading Monish's letter, basically debriefing on what happened with Horsehead. And he told him something along the lines of, you know, learn from it, but don't learn too much. I guess, in other words, like, you know, it's a mistake. It happens. It's kind of par for the course. And I've had investments like that where I've lost a little bit of money before. And I still come away from a lot of those things kind of thinking that I would make that same bet again if it was presented to me. Do you have similar takeaways from that, or are there key things that you think you just genuinely missed that should have been picked up?
No, I think the investment thesis was sound, saying that, you know, but I think it was just the position size. It's something we should, you know, we really are limiting ourselves to 10% at the most with a highly, you know, with a lot of conviction that's as much of our portfolio as we would put into any one position. And that's a lot for us. And this was well over that.
Yeah.
And again, it was the, we wanted to change our life so quickly, and we thought this could potentially be it. Because yeah. I think
we thought it was a golden ticket.
Yeah, we easily thought it could 10x. And it was really down to this refining plant they had in North Carolina getting up and running. And it just had some teething problems very early on. And it really, they had their debt called. And a fairly aggressive hedge fund owned most of their debt. And their assets were marked down on their balance sheet. And then basically there was nothing left when the primary debt lender got paid. So shareholders lost everything. But and it's been too painful for us to actually go back and see as a private company how the Horsehead is doing. They're probably doing very well.
They're probably doing great. Hedge fund is probably real happy.
Right. So Horsehead's still around. It's come out of bankruptcy and it's the new plant's operational, is it?
Well, I think so. It's a little bit of a...
We're still bitter. It's still salty for us.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's interesting like how these things play out. I guess the lesson coming out of that is portfolio allocation and I think people hear the old Warren Buffett talks where he says if I was only managing $1 million I'd have 50% in my best idea and I'd be making 50% a year and I've been reading The Snowball. I'm not sure if you guys have read that or not, the Warren Buffett biography, but some of the stories of stocks that he was able to purchase and that, he was buying, I think in one example, he had about 50 or 60% of his portfolio in one stock, but it was trading at like 0.5 times earnings or something like that.
Right.
So that's the environment where Buffett was talking about making 50% bets. It's not, paying... Yeah. 10 times sales for some new software company that's grown really fast.
Exactly. And
that's
everything,
So, and unfortunately, the three of us aren't Warren Buffett either. So we probably have to scale things down, right?
Isn't that lame? I wish we were.
We can dream. Now, I hope you enjoyed that clip of the painful story of Sam and Chris's adventure with Horsehead Holdings a few years back. And next, we're going to move to Matthew Peterson of Peterson Capital Management. And we're going to look at two clips, both from an interview that was done, actually our only in-person podcast interview of the year, with Matt at his home in Austin, Texas. Now, Matt Peterson runs Peterson Capital Management. He's been on the podcast a couple of times. He is a focused value style investor who we actually got the chance to meet in person initially in Omaha, Nebraska at the Berkshire meeting and then, of course, again in Texas when we recorded this episode. So I'm going to look at two clips here. The first one is from Matt talking about his put and call option strategy that he calls sort of structured value, and he uses that as a bit of an overlay to his core value investing approach. The second clip is we're going to get some thoughts from Matt on some of his investments in Turkey, which is a part of the world that has some pretty wild macroeconomic issues with a lot of inflation, and Matt shares why he's so interested in investing in Turkey. It was also very cool to have Hamish Hodder co-hosting this episode with me, so let's roll into these couple of clips from the interview with Matt.
Right, okay. And then typically when you're writing these put option contracts to kind of enter a position, how are you kind of structuring that? Are you doing kind of like staggered over different time periods, different, it's some in the money, some out of the money? Like what does that kind of look like for your fund?
So it's such a good question because as you start applying this rigorously, you start to realize that you get all sorts of ways to sort of diversify and almost cost average through these products. So you can adjust your strike price. You can adjust the premium that you're willing to accept. So you can sell for a variety of prices. You can also adjust your expiration date. So if you, so ultimately I end up building sort of a three-dimensional matrix and we're selling things with different strike prices, four different prices that expire at different times. And if there's a contract that say is going to expire with a strike of 100, and we have contracts expiring in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and 24 months, we may end up with some where we buy and some that expire and we don't buy. And what that means is ultimately within that same position, we've really lowered our cost basis down to a very low price per share. So if we're trying to buy 1,000 shares, if we're willing to buy 1,000 shares, but we end up with 500 of those shares, we may have picked up $20 in premium on each contract. So it's sort of become, if we pick up only half, we've now sort of picked up 40 on that half. So instead of buying for 100, if that's the market price, we're in for 80, or maybe we're in for 60, but it's a very valuable tool. So we structure it with this sort of matrix in mind, where we take our full notional exposure that we'd wish to have. And at the end, as things expire, we can always write more contracts if it still provides us with adequate IRR.
Yeah, okay. And obviously, I think with option contracts, they're in buckets of kind of 100 shares. So this is probably having the three-dimensional matrix that you're talking about is something that kind of comes with some level of scale, I guess. Was this something that, I think your fund started with $100,000 a few years ago? So were you still using put options? And of course, I would imagine that the matrix wasn't as complex, but how did you kind of go about structuring your put options when you were relatively smaller?
That's a great question. so we launched with $125,000. Within a few months, we had over a million and that type of thing. But even with a million, it's sort of difficult because you're let's say you're willing to have only 10 positions, you still need to allocate $100,000, which, you know, but you can build out the matrix with that size, as long as you're dealing with, it depends on the price of the underlying stock. So if you're dealing with a Berkshire or a Google, or Netflix or Tesla, your notional becomes very large, because the price of the underlying shares are expensive. So you can do it with one put contract, though. You don't need to wait till you can build out the whole matrix. If you want to buy the shares, I started implementing this in about 2005, and it happened very organically for me. I was working out on Wall Street, and I was working with all these different trading desks at Goldman Sachs, trying to work out these models and things for them. And I just recognized that it was so silly to buy through the New York Stock Exchange when I could sell a put contracts and get put the shares. So it would just make it, I could just buy it for less than the retail investor. And I didn't have millions of dollars back then. So I was doing it with a small amount of capital, and I would just simply sell one or two put contracts on the shares I want to hold. And it still wasn't any form of speculation. Once we received the shares, we're long-term buy and hold investors, just like Warren and Charlie. And so we were building out this portfolio. We think of ourselves as owners, and we'll hold those shares for a long time. But even with one put contract, there's an advantage. You lower your cost basis below the retail price of a stock.
Mm. Right. And you're typically doing selling calls on the way out as well to sell
right.
for a higher price as
that's
well.
That's right. So in a, again, just sort of generic scenario, if instead of it costing 100, you get a $20 premium and it costs you 80, when those shares go up to 400, you, instead of selling for 400, can now turn around and maybe sell with a strike of 450 and pick up another $30 and be out at 480. Mm-hmm. So, the shares may never go to 480, and they maybe never dropped all the way to 80, but, and I'm sort of trying to create easy math for myself, but instead of buying for 100 and selling for 400, you'd make 300%. Instead, you're in for 80 and selling for 480, I guess you'd make 500%, like 6x, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's a very real tangible advantage. I mean, your portfolio, if you had $1 million, instead of it being now 400 million, now it's 600 million. So it's real money.
Crazy.
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. I highly
recommend you implement this in your own
portfolio. We were talking about this last night, and Hamish has been digging into Netflix a lot lately.
Yeah, it's like, kind of been a bit of a rabbit hole.
Well, I think we've got about 15 minutes left. So one other topic we're keen to cover with you, again, which is quite a unique kind of thing you're doing, is investing in Turkey. A place
Let's keep it controversial.
Yeah, a place that has some
I mean, some interesting businesses, and you can maybe tell us about that, but it sort of has this big macro overhang of high inflation, high interest rates.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll call them
unconventional economic policy.
There you go. Yeah. So I mean, what attracts you to Turkey in the first place? And I mean, do those factors play into how you analyze businesses over there at all? Or are you still very sort of focused on the micro?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Turkey is great hunting grounds for a value investor, but you need to be really familiar with what you're doing because there's so many unique aspects when you get into these developing markets. So my wife is Turkish. I've spent a lot of my adult life in Turkey. About 7-8 years ago, through Guy Spier's ValueX conference in Switzerland, mm-hmm. I was introduced to Mesut Eliotolu, who's like the number one Turkish equity analyst globally. He was the head of ABN AMRO's, he was the investment officer for ABN AMRO, Turkey. He has been focused on the same 400 equities for a successful 30-year career. And 200 of them, you don't touch anyway. So there's right. like 200 firms that he's been evaluating. And it's shocking the knowledge that he has. I mean, he knows the C-suites and their predecessors and their predecessor's predecessor. And I really get the deep sense when he walks in the room, people are intimidated by Mesut because he knows the company better than
the new CEO. Yeah.
That said, as you mentioned, you know, they're in a sort of a look, it's a controversial place in the world. Erdogan is a very controversial figure, political leader. And these unconventional policies that I joked about is that they're going through like massive inflation. There's currency depreciation. And when inflation happens in Turkey, when inflation happens anywhere in the world, economic 101 is that you raise interest rates, you know, you lower the money supply, and then there's less demands for a given good, and it could slow your inflation. Hopefully it does. Mm-hmm. In Turkey, when there's high inflation, they just lower interest rates and it creates a positive feedback loop, which is horrible for the economy.
Wow.
So, or I guess maybe you'd call it a negative feedback loop, but it's inflationary.
Yeah.
So they're putting inflationary policy on top of an already inflationary environment. And guess what? It didn't work. So, 15 years ago, it was about 1.3 lira for a dollar. And today it's about 15 lira for a dollar. So you can imagine a scenario where like your currency just depreciates 90%. And so these are all factors. We are well aware that we don't hedge the currency. We are well aware that the currency is a depreciating asset, and there's unconventional economic policies that are pushing it in that direction. But we are focused so much on the microeconomic factors. So if you're in that scenario, we're looking at businesses that have like a global footprint. So maybe they're earning euros in revenue. They're earning, their revenue's coming in dollars. Their revenue's coming in euros, but their expenses are in lira. So their costs are going down and their revenue is stable. Also, we're looking at really solid global companies that are trading on the Borsa Exchange. So as the lira falls, they just naturally become cheaper. We are spending dollars to make these purchases. So if the lira gets cut in half, the companies we were looking to buy just get cut in half. Further, foreign investors leave. So there's almost a decline. If they just sell the index, there might be a decline in the general price. So in Turkey, we are finding opportunities where you can truly capture like PEs of one. You can find things trading for 3x earnings, 4x wow. earnings. And you need to be comfortable with volatility because the prices are not efficient. They're inefficient. So information doesn't flow as quickly as they would in a developed market. So, and that's why these opportunities exist. So Mesut and I launched a separate fund from Peterson a few years ago called Talus. And you can go to Talus and we lay out all the companies we own and they're just spectacular. So sometimes it's hard to get in. You would need a special tax ID and things like that. But um, but you're able to purchase a few of the bigger ones if you like it. They're exceptional opportunities over there.
Yeah. Is there a concern that, I mean, these businesses are really cheap on a valuation basis. Is there a concern or is there a catalyst that you look for the market to kind of become more efficient? Because obviously looking at the US market, for example, you might see an inefficiency and you're hoping that over the next few years that gap is kind of closed. Is that something that you treat differently in Turkey? Is it the same? Like, how do you kind of navigate that?
That's a wonderful question. So, we do sort of need catalysts. It's a different type of investing when you're in emerging markets. So, because the prices could be wrong for a long time, and you have to sit there and wait, and you're sort of, it impacts your annualized IRR while you're waiting. Mm-hmm. I will share with you a situation in the current environment. We were just out talking with Anadolu Hayat, which is one of the largest insurers, and they're moving into all these pensions and asset management businesses. It's a great company. The chairman, we met with the chair and C-suite. The chairman used to be the CEO of Isbank. And to put it in perspective, it's sort of like you're sort of just talking to Jamie Dimon. And we're sitting there, we bring a tour over. So we did a tour in January. And there's about 10 of us just asking him questions, and explaining all sorts of things. And we get to hear this from multiple individuals. But coming from him, it's quite interesting where he says, basically, he explained to us that, and we already knew this a little bit, but he confirmed this. There's an election scheduled for next year. Now, Erdogan, we're not sure what's going to happen. Erdogan's had a way of maintaining his power. But they've put in place so many of these unorthodox policies and seen them fail that even the current administration knows that it was a mistake. They just can't go back on it until the election because they will lose their base. So what we were told is that no matter who wins the election in March, we will move to conventional economic policy. So we will start to now raise interest rates to counteract inflation. We will treat, you know, the economy as it should be treated, rather than sort of experimenting and shooting from the hip. So the catalyst for a lot of these opportunities is going to come next March. Now, the election could be pulled early. They could just announce that they're going to make an election, and then, you know, the incumbent has the advantage. So maybe they announce that they're going to do an election in August. Or it could be postponed a little bit, but the election will occur. And once that election happens, many of our holdings could like triple overnight because they're just so mispriced. If you get a good stable business selling for 3 or 4 times earnings, it can just readjust and sell for 8 or 9. And these are growing companies also.
Big thanks to Matt Peterson again for sharing his thoughts and strategies in those couple of clips on that episode. Next, we're going to move to a second interview, actually, that I did with Guy Speer. It was great to get Guy back on the podcast. This one was filmed actually after meeting Guy Speer in person at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting in late April, early May. And again, they say that you learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. And in this clip, we're going to look at Guy Speer's story of his investment in LH. LH is actually a stock that Guy Speer sold in the early 2000s in many ways due to just fear, because the business was running into a few short-term headwinds and the stock price was down a lot. And had Guy Speer held on to that position from the bottom, it would have been more than a 100 to 1 return. It's a story that Guy had never shared publicly, so I'm very grateful to Guy for being willing to share the story on the podcast. So let's check out this clip from Guy talking about his investment in LH.
And so the story that, for those listeners who are interested, that I told Tom, that I've told it privately, but I haven't told it publicly in this kind of forum, so, and I'm really happy to do it, is the story of my experience with Laboratory Corporations of America. You know, this all happened in the early 2000s, so there I was. I'd actually had the opportunity to shake hands with Lou Simpson, who was one of Warren Buffett's lieutenants, an extremely talented and capable investor, who suddenly a new position appears in his portfolio, a company called Laboratory Corporation of America. And this was a merger between a company called BioReference Labs, which was partly owned by Roche in Switzerland, and National Health Labs, which was an American company. And this was the future of lab testing, blood lab testing, was high capital expenditures, but many, many tests, which would be very expensive and only capable of being done by the largest, most capitalized labs. And so this was clearly going to be one of the winners in a consolidating industry. And there was potentially one competitor emerging, and they'd taken a certain amount of debt to do the merger. And there was years of endless growth ahead of them. And then they had what I remember as a technical default on their debt, and the share price rapidly dropped from $8 a share approximately, which is where I had bought it, to $2 a share. And so at that point, so far, so good, because that is just the normal course of business in the stock market. Things happen. Things don't always turn out the way you expect them to. The last 5 or 6 years has been a very unusual period. And again, that's where the rubber hits the road. And for the benefit of the viewer, I made a number of really big mistakes or a number of errors that I would prefer not to have made. So first of all, nothing other than a quotational loss, and you're talking about a 75% loss on my purchase, which is about what some people have in some of their SaaS tech businesses. And but nothing else had happened. Nobody was yelling, "You idiot." Nobody was telling me to sell the shares. I don't know what would have happened when I reported to investors, if I would have gotten redemption requests or not. But at this point, none of that has happened. So a first mistake is that I went into a funk. All I could do was think about this company. I had other companies in my portfolio, but all I could do was think about this company and how much money I'd lost on a quotational loss. And in this case, the bankers were Credit Suisse, and they had a very close relationship with Roche. And they took a penalty from the company, and they modified the loan agreement. So it wasn't like the company was about to go into Chapter 11 or anything like that. It had a solid set of shareholders who were totally capable, if necessary, of recapitalizing the company, but that wasn't even necessary. They just needed a modification on one of the sort of covenants on the loan, as I remember. In any case, I couldn't think of anything else, and eventually the pressure came too great for me, and I sold the shares at $2 a share and felt so much better afterwards because the position was cleared out and I didn't have to think about it anymore. And that was that. And I tried to forget I ever owned it and tried to forget that I ever bought it. 5 or 6 years later, I discovered that Chieftain Capital Management owned shares of the company. I don't remember the name of the guy leading it, of kind of like buy and hold long-term investors. In any case, the results for the company were that it was more from the $2 a share, it ended up at more than 100 or 200x, perhaps even more. It's too painful for me to do the study. The most profound fact about that is that if all I had done was done nothing, if I just held on to my shares at $8 a share, I would have made a lot more than 20 times my original investment. 20 times. My original analysis was right. All I had to do was sit there and do nothing, and I failed to do that. So in retrospect, did I pay too much for the company? Perhaps at that particular moment, and I bought into the flush of excitement at the merger and the fact that Lou Simpson had bought a bunch of shares, and I bought in the midst of enthusiasm, but then I doubled down on that mistake by selling it at the wrong time. And so, you know, I think that many investors right now are waking up to realize that they've made the mistake of overpaying. But I think that in many cases that I know of, they've actually bought into some extraordinary businesses. And what Charlie Munger says is that often the pain in the markets happen not because of a bad idea, but because of a good idea that was taken too far. And so many of these companies are extremely well managed. They have some super high quality people running them. They are, not all of them, but some of them, and perhaps many of them, are extraordinarily good businesses. I believe that those people that I know who are invested in them have done good research, excellent research, beyond excellent research. And yes, perhaps they've paid too much for them, which is easy to see now. But it would be a great shame to compound that mistake by selling at the wrong time, if you like. And so that was a signal lesson to me. And perhaps that is helpful for some people who are sort of licking wounds right now.
Next, let's move to Mitch and Cass Dole, one of my favorite investing couples out of Australia. They are full-time investors in their early 30s and have been on the podcast a few times now. I first had them on to talk about their Big Short in 2020. They were short Australian travel companies right before the pandemic, after kind of catching wind of what might be coming very early in 2020. As you can imagine, that worked out very successfully. And secondly, I had them on to talk about a hedge they were doing in their portfolio around inflation and rising interest rates. They came on the podcast kind of in real time in December of 2021 to lay out their plans in terms of what they were going to do to hedge what they thought would be increases in interest rates and inflation, which obviously turned out to be quite correct. And this update clip from Mitch and Cass was filmed in June 2022, and they gave us a bit of an update on how their bond short was tracking so far.
Mitch, Cass, welcome back to the podcast, round three. Stars of the Big Short 2.0 coming up here in a couple of years. How are you both?
We're doing pretty good, Tom.
We're good, Tom. We're hanging on for dear life. We're hodling for dear life. Yes. It's the only part of this whole crypto nonsense that we like is the word hodl.
Hodl.
So we are hodling. Yeah.
I like it. Well, like I said, we've had you guys on the podcast a couple of times now. Firstly, we talked about kind of a big hedge you did in 2020 to do with COVID, which worked out extremely well. In December, we kind of had you on in real time talking about an upcoming hedge that you were just putting on at the time, which was to do with inflation. And fast forward 6 months, it seems to have been working pretty well. So how has the last few months been for you both?
It's been really good. It's been quite a wild ride, that's for sure. Like the rest of our portfolio has been, you know, punched in the face, like everyone's portfolio probably has, because we're quite concentrated. But yeah, the hedge has performed really well. So at the time that we started the hedge, originally we spoke to you, we bought puts on HYG and LQD, and then we changed our mind within a week after speaking to you about it, that, you know, it wasn't long enough duration, and, you know, betting against longer duration bonds made a lot more sense. So we did that, started at 4%. And then continue to kind of learn about the Federal Reserve and learn about, you know, how that whole system works and how their communication works. And then it kind of peaked. I think it might have been even up to 14% of our portfolio. We kept kind of adding to the hedge.
In TLT. Yeah.
Yeah, puts on TLT. And we still hold about 80% of what we originally bought. And the hedge itself is up about 500%. And that's helped our portfolio to be up about 45-50%, something like that, as of now. So we still hold the hedge. Could still go against us, but it's looking pretty good so far.
Goes against us every fortnight.
Every fortnight. it always moves up and down.
If you look at the TLT chart from December until now, you'll see like a steady up and down in my emotions.
Yeah.
It's like, it's been volatile, but...
It has, but yeah. it's worked out well.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm interested to spend a bit of time talking through maybe the psychology of this, because I listened to your podcast just yesterday, and you're saying even though it's a reasonable size position now, but that position on its own is moving the portfolio up and down like 10% in a day, right? That's kind of the numbers you're seeing.
It is. And it's a new experience to have a position that big, that we feel we understand so well, and we're so confident, and we don't feel we're justified in selling yet. We feel that, you know, with the quantitative tightening still really just beginning. So the process has gone pretty much from, you know, central banks were buying bonds in the market, you know, $50-60 billion a month they were putting into the bond market. they actually own 40% of all of the long-term bond market, the Federal Reserve does. So, you know, to go from that point to basically now where they're actually not buying any bonds whatsoever, pretty much, you know, they're still buying a little bit here and there as their old bonds roll off. But yeah, we're still kind of coming in, we feel, to the main pressure point of the bond market where, you know, real buyers are going to have to step up. And, you know, with inflation almost 9%, real people with their own money are going to have to say, yeah, we think 3.2% for 30 years is a great deal, you know, at this point. So we're still pretty happy to hold it for now.
Now, this wouldn't be a true Investing with Tom podcast highlight reel without including a clip from Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor. Jason is a crowd favorite. He's become a pretty good friend of mine. We talk most weeks on WhatsApp about various things investing related. And in 2022, Jason put on quite a big position in Google or Alphabet, and he spent quite a bit of time kind of breaking down his thesis with that particular investment. Now, in the episode that I did with Jason, he spent quite a bit of time on Google and Alphabet. So I'm just going to play the first half of Jason's thoughts. This is going to be focused on Alphabet's underlying business. If you want to hear sort of the second part of what Jason had to say about Alphabet to do with the numbers, then of course head over and check out the full episode that I did with Jason. This highlight clip comes from episode 36 of the podcast.
Skip past this bit. So let's talk Google. Yeah. I know you're pretty involved with Google in your day job. I would hope you have some pretty nice insights into this particular business. And it sounds like it's a brand new position in 2022, as far as I know, and a pretty big one for you. So what's the deal with Google?
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with Google. I work in digital marketing. Maybe you should talk to Jack and ask him to check his emails every now and then, because all I do, Tom, is send Jack advice emails on your guys' podcast. So many marketing ideas. Nice. There's one I shared on my podcast, which I did a podcast. I came back to Tea Time the other day and I was too rusty, so I took it down. But in that one, and I'll share it here now, I came up with the idea there needs to be a punch card conference once a year. Like, it's so hot where I am, Tom, in Oklahoma. It's so hot. 44 degrees Celsius.
Come to New Zealand. It's middle of winter.
If you do the punch card in New Zealand, I would love to go. Like, that's what I want you guys to do. I want to travel more. I want the whole gang to get together. And you guys need to put on the punch card conference. And all the listeners loved it when I shared the idea. And I told them to all ask you guys about when is the conference happening without even explaining to you what it is. But you guys could all get together. The audience could get together. We'll pay money. You guys can use that money to give us food, and you can bring in some speakers to pitch stock ideas and give us interesting business lectures. It can start small, but I thought that'd be an awesome idea. So anyway, I'm involved with marketing. Google's a big part of marketing these days. And I got into Google stock like in 2015 or 2014 or 2015, whenever they did like a stock split and renamed the company Alphabet. And the Michael Jordan of CFOs, Ruth Porat, I think she was at one of the big banks in New York City. She came over to Google around that time as a CFO and kind of changed the way the company presents itself to investors and tells its story and all that kind of stuff. And the moral of this story is I got lucky. I bought Google cheap, didn't know what I was doing back then. Google, I bought it at like $600 or something. This was pre-split. Goes up to $1,800 for reference. Forget that. It goes up to, I think, $1,200 or $1,500 or something. I sell, which was the stupidest thing I could have ever done. And then it goes up like a double or a triple from there or something like that. So I learned my lesson. And ever since then, I've been kind of biding my time waiting to get back in there. And I have an article about this, why I made Google a 25% position on my website. I've got a lot of stuff on my mind, Tom. I forget a lot of things. And it was good to go back and read this article, because this was a heck of an investment. Like, my reasoning, how simple I kept it, it was really good. And I haven't done anything with it. I've just kind of kept it there since then, since May. And I plan to basically, as I always say every time I'm recorded on the internet, never sell this investment ever and then things happen and sometimes I sell. But it's a wonderful business. It's a compounder. I'm going to hold it. I learned my lesson and we can get into why. But that's kind of my history with Google.
Cool. Well, maybe give us the rundown. I haven't really ever done a deep dive on Google. Obviously, they've got Google Search, they've got YouTube, they've got a cloud business, which I must say I don't know a huge amount about. So, how are you thinking about kind of the main aspects of the business, what the future looks like for them, and then give us kind of some of the numbers. I mean, at the end of the day, wonderful business versus price is kind of the key.
Yeah, so let's and I like the way the order you lay it out there. Let's talk about the wonderful business aspect, then let's talk about why I bought now. So wonderful business. They have search. Obviously, their market share in search is huge. And when I think about search, I think about that business continuing to grow. I think about that business being dominant. And also, I think about that business, and I see it all the time. It's a win-win-win. Charlie Munger approved, if I may. I would say it's a, who knows what he thinks about it. But when we hear Charlie Munger and people who talk to Charlie Munger talk about win-win-win, it's one of those win-win-wins for me. Obviously, Google wins when people click on ads and send money to Google. Businesses win because unlike some other platforms, it's marketing that actually works and produces profits for those businesses. And then customers win because they get connected with really great businesses and get exactly what they're looking for, whether they click on an ad or whether they're just using the search product in general. Also, I think customers win with YouTube. Like, yes, we're happy to watch ads because the amount of entertainment and knowledge we get for free is so amazing. Think of all the creators like yourself that are winning through YouTube and all the businesses that can get exposed to their audiences through YouTube. It's just a win-win-win environment. So for various reasons, I see their advertising business continuing to get stronger and grow. YouTube is 2 billion users. It's great. There's magic about it, and it only gets better and better as more people get on here and spend time here and create here. And then their cloud business, according to my article, when I looked at it in May, is growing at 40% a year. And as my understanding of it is they're number three, and they're a growing number three. You've got Amazon, you've got Microsoft, and you've got Google, and then way past that, you've got the rest. And so they're in the top three and they're growing. On top of all of that, you've got a lottery ticket, which is Waymo, which is their driverless robo taxi business, driverless cars. My understanding of it is that in an area of Arizona, Waymo vehicles are driving around at certain parts of the day, possibly driving customers with nobody in the vehicle. So it's like a real thing that's happening. And that's what I'm calling a lottery ticket because I'm happy to buy all of that other stuff for the price of Google. And I'm getting that for free. So could be wrong about Waymo, but they're in the mix when it comes to driverless. And I think that's going to be a huge, huge industry. So that's the business. And you want to get into the numbers?
Now, during November and December, we had a bit of a flurry of new guests on the podcast, and one of those was Brett Kelly, who is the CEO and founder of Kelly Partners, an ASX-listed accounting firm. And Brett actually has his own podcast and recently got the opportunity to interview NBA legend Shaquille O'Neal. So here's what Brett had to say about that experience with interviewing Shaq.
Recently, I interviewed Shaquille O'Neal for our podcast. How did I get that idea? My kids are 17, they're 15, 10. They're really committed. They've got smart friends. And they're like, Dad, Shaq's coming to Australia. Did you know he'd done this? No. I start researching him. The guy's an extraordinary business person. I think an extraordinary leader. Humble about the mistakes that he's made in his life and inspiring to other people. I pursued him over 9 days or 2 weeks. We had 9 days notice that he'd do it. Who did I put in the room? Potential future employees, current employees, existing clients, future clients. I signed up all the future employees. I signed up all the future clients. I put the kids of our clients in there and inspired the kids. He loved it. He said it was the best thing he did in Australia. I put it on YouTube. We got over 300,000 views. We got 10 million views on an ESPN clip that we shared. ESPN wanted to share it. They shared it. We're building the brand on a global basis, and frankly, it was quite cheap. So we'll do offbeat things. but they're all aligned to these values. What would happen if you really genuinely believe that your role was to make people better off, which means healthier, wealthier, and wiser, and you just use the vehicle of your profession to do that? And tax? No one likes paying tax, my friend. So they're always up for a chat about how to minimize that. And while they're having that chat, we try to make their life better, which means get them personally, business, wealth, estate, learning, and holidays organized so that they can be the best person they can be, so they can be the best business owner they can be. And that's a winning formula. We're confident of that at this point. The business is nearly 17 years old. It's compounded a cumulative average growth rate of over 30%. It's doubled 5 times in a row. This is not a new thing. And so that's the model. That's where it comes from. And if anyone thinks they can duplicate that, that's cool. Like, I encourage, you know, what's that? Mimicry is the best form of flattery. I don't care. I care about doing the best that we can do every day.
Very cool. I was going to ask you about the Shaq podcast as well. I believe he's a shareholder now. Is that correct?
Well, we gave him $1,000 worth of shares. Yeah. And then he asked me, could he get, I think, $1 million or $5 million if he landed that hoop. It was the only shot he took on the entire Australian tour. I said I'd back that with my own shares, mind you, and I was prepared to. Thankfully, he missed. But, I must look up whether he's claimed his shares. It might be a bit small fry for him. But, you know, he identified the mission that we're trying to solve.
Next up, we have Monsoon Prabhai, who was one of the most popular guests that we had all year, I believe coming in second, right behind Guy Spear, and what I believe was Monsoon's very first podcast appearance. Now, Monsoon grew up around a number of super investors, which is probably to be expected, given that she's the daughter of legendary value investor Monish Prabhai. But Monsoon is a very rational thinker in her own right and has really got her head screwed on straight when it comes to talking through investment principles. So in this clip, let's take a look at what Monsoon had to say about some of her international investing adventures, specifically in India and Turkey. Yeah. And you mentioned you spent a fair bit of time in India, you know, meeting a lot of different management teams, yeah, by the sounds of it. So, does the portfolio, or are you open to investing basically anywhere? Do you have holdings in India, for example?
So yeah, the fund is it's a global mandate. It's actually a small percentage in India right now, just because it takes a little bit of time to get access locally in the country, but the moment we have access, I would hope it's like 15 to 20% of the fund, just because that's a country I spend a lot of time in, and a market I think I understand pretty well. But yeah, I think with emerging market investing, you have to spend some amount of time in that country, or you have to have really good friends on the ground to talk to, but it's always worth the visit.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your trips to Turkey as well.
Yeah, I just made one trip to Turkey where I accompanied my dad and his team. Tons of fun. I was definitely more of a fly on the wall on that meeting. We met, I want to say, 40 management teams, maybe 30 to 40 management teams. I think both my dad and I agree there's 4 companies there that were somewhat investable. But there was one I walked out of saying, this is like, you don't even need to do any more work on this. This is like the most obvious pick. And I think my dad looked horrified at me. He said, you are not my daughter. You are Guy's daughter in the way you pick your businesses. And I told him the other 3 were, I mean, they're great businesses and they would require a lot more work, but I just like couldn't sit as comfortable with him as he could. I don't even have access to Turkey right now. It was kind of more just like of a learning trip. But it was great. It was great. Just kind of, that was the first time he and I had done, we had done company visits where we were both managing our own fund. Because before his first trip to India, meeting management teams, I actually accompanied him, but I was a senior in college. And so I was applying to Dalton and he said, hey, you know, you're interviewing for the India team and I'm thinking of making an India trip. Why don't you come with? So that was the first one. And I was just like a student in college. So it's kind of fun growing up with him, and we're just both investing.
Awesome. And what was it that really got you interested with that one company?
Well, with that Honestly, just like really consistent revenues, a really easy business model that you can just understand. Almost like a monkey can run it. Not that many people are involved in the operation. That's it. I just think the moment you add like complex layers, different revenue, like lines of business and everything, it gets a lot more complicated. And the more it looks like a lemonade stand in my head, the easier it is to work with valuation and like comfort with different risks the business may take on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. And presumably there was like, you had an idea of some basic valuation metrics going into that meeting to kind of work off as well.
Before we go into every meeting, we're pretty well prepped on what is the business and what we want to ask. But that we definitely both came out excited, but I was way more excited.
Now, the final guest of the year on the podcast was Jake Taylor of Farnham Street Investments. He's also the author of The Rebel Allocator, the founder of Journalytic, and the co-host of the Value After Hours podcast. And this clip is sort of a highlight to the power of highlights. This is a clip that Jake explains where he got a call from Charlie Munger a couple of months after having released his book. Charlie gave Jake a call completely out of the blue to compliment him on just how good kind of the book was. And Charlie shared some thoughts on that book potentially getting made into a movie. He thought that would be quite a cool idea. So let's play this clip of Jake talking about that famous call from Charlie Munger.
Shockingly awesome, like people who I would have never thought would have read it and sent me nice letters. Like, I don't want to name names, but like, just, I couldn't believe it. And including a call, which you referenced too.
Yeah, well, let's name one name, which is Charlie Munger. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, I was just in my office one day a few months after the book came out, and my assistant tells me that I have a call and that it's Charlie Munger. And I was like, come on, don't mess with me. That's not funny. But then turns out it was Charlie Munger, and he just wanted to talk about the book and actually thought it would be awesome if I made it into a movie. And it was one of the most surreal 30 minutes of my life to talk to one of my heroes about a book that I wrote that I wasn't sure anyone would ever read.
Yeah, that's absolutely insane. You must have thought it was like Bill or Toby messing with you or something.
I thought for sure somebody was messing with me. Like, yeah, what are the chances? I mean, just so seems so vanishingly small.
Yeah. Is there anything else you're happy to share kind of from that call with Charlie?
Well, you know what? Probably the weirdest part of it, the whole thing, was that you know, this was like 2019-ish, and I had been lamenting in my quarterly letters to clients that I was having a hard time finding things to buy at that point that made sense to me. Those no-brainers that I talked about, you know, being opportunistic mm-hmm. about. And he told me, apparently Charlie had gone back and read some of my letters, because he said, you know, I'd be more worried about you if you were finding lots of good ideas right now. So somehow, I don't know, he found time to read some of my letters as well before we chatted on the phone, which is even probably a smaller chance that ever happened than the book. So,
yeah, that's got to feel absolutely insane. Do you know how how he stumbled across you, or did you send him the book, or do you know how that all actually started?
Yeah, I did send him a copy of the book. I sent it to, you know, people who were influential, because he's a, like this main the kind of, well, actually, so just to back up a little bit, like the book is modeled basically after The Karate Kid as the storyline would play out, except imagine, you know, that Daniel-san is trying to learn about capital allocation from Mr. Miyagi. And so the old, you know, Mr. Miyagi character is an amalgamation of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and, you know, a bunch of my business heroes basically kind of rolled into one. And like, what would they say if they were asked these questions by someone who's younger and just trying to learn the ropes?
Very cool. How did that idea for taking that approach to writing an investment book actually start?
Well, you know, I originally sketched out a nonfiction book, as you'd probably expect for a topic like capital allocation. And it just seemed like it was going to be so boring. Like, I couldn't even want to read it. And so that was, you know, looking for stories as a way to make it more interesting. One day I was just sitting and thinking, like, well, who's good at telling stories? And I thought, well, Hollywood, right? So I actually read a couple books on screenplays, and then I used what I learned in that screenplay writing books to then sketch out, you know, like actually like scene by scene of the book of how it would play out. Like I had it on like 3x5 index cards, you know, as you would do a screenplay. And so that was how the flow of the story was sort of constructed. And then I could just sprinkle the lessons within there to have like a building up of knowledge for the main character.
Love it. And do you feel like that's a project you'll ever, you know, is there going to be a Rebel Allocator 2? Or you feel like you've ticked that off and you're happy that you've achieved?
It'd be real, really difficult because that book had, you know, 20 years worth of things that I'd stumbled across that I thought were smart and interesting, and I, you know, condensed down into that story. It's going to take me so long to fill that hopper back up to where I could feel like I had anything that was remotely as important. And maybe it's possible I might never, because of just sort of the law of diminishing returns. Like I probably found most of the important things already. Mm-hmm. That the idea of getting as much of that again filled up is like so daunting. It's hard to imagine doing it again.
Yeah, fair enough. I asked William Green a very similar question about Ritualizer Happier 2.0, and yeah, there was sort of like a look of horror that just went across his face around how daunting that would be. It's like 20 plus years of interviews, you know, into 300 pages.
Yeah. Same issue that I would feel if I tried to tackle that project.
And so that concludes some of the highlights from the podcast and what has been an amazing year in 2022. I genuinely appreciate all the support that the podcast has gotten, and I'm really, really looking forward to getting some great new guests on the show in 2023. Now again, if you would like to contribute to the podcast in any way, the simplest thing you can do is just share it with a friend. But if you'd like to help out monetarily in any way, I have enabled Super Thanks over on the YouTube version of the podcast if you're interested in contributing there. But like I said at the start of the episode, you might as well get yourself a deal if you're interested in supporting the podcast. So there is a link to Sharesight, which is one of the longtime partners of mine here on YouTube. It's the portfolio tracking software that I've used for years at this point. You can get free access to Sharesight or 4 months free off of a premium subscription by using the link in the description below, sharesight.com/investingwithtom. Again, I truly appreciate all the support for the podcast throughout this year. I hope everyone has a fantastic holiday season, however you choose to celebrate it, and I will see you again in 2023.